Hello, boys and girls, and welcome to episode number 139 of the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman. Today's episode is sponsored by Braintree and DreamHost and features the very talented Mr. Touch himself, Josh Clark. Josh.
Well, hello. I feel like that nickname could get me into trouble in some places, but thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's a trigger word for me, actually, but I'm glad to have you here. Josh is the author of Designing for Touch, a new and amazing book from, it's called A Book Apart. And as a matter of fact, for listeners of this podcast, there is a 15% discount on Josh's new book if you use the code DFT Big Web, and that stands for Designing for Touch. DFT Big Web, it's good for 15% off Josh's book, valid now until the end of January. So don't delay. Go to abookapart.com today if you like what we're talking about today and buy this amazing book. Josh, welcome. You're in Brooklyn this morning?
I am, yeah. I'm happy to be at home, which is a rare thing these last few weeks.
I know you were just, I've been following you on Twitter and Foursquare, on Swarm. And it's, what was the thing you were writing on Twitter? It looked like a series of haikus about a post-apocalyptic, I guess you were on your way back from LaGuardia last night or this morning?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, sometimes it's like when things are going wrong at the airport and the you start to feel the crowd start to vibrate and it gets to be this sort of tribal vibe happening in the crowd. And the airports can feel a little bit post-apocalyptic, and to sort of keep myself kind of from losing my mind, I have found that I've started writing weird sort of sci-fi post-apocalyptic fiction in Twitter.
Micro-publishing really helps me when I'm frightened or frustrated. Like, I get hurt. People think it's crazy, but like, I get injured and I'm tweeting about it like a second later. But I do the same thing at airports when, like, I've also noticed a strange thing about airport psychology, which is if you're delayed a sufficient amount of times because of like during Hurricane Sandy, I was flying back to New York at the beginning of the hurricane. At a certain point, you just want to get on the plane, even if you're going to die. At a certain point, you get delayed so many, and then you get on the plane and then they make you get off again. And you're sitting there and like, you don't have, you haven't eaten in like 8 hours. And at a certain point, even if they say there's a very good chance this plane will go down, but we can go for it if we go right now, everybody's like, yeah, let's go. I mean, have you had that experience?
Well, I know. I think that there's in general always a sense of steady panic at the airport, and you see it in the way that people board or get off the plane, or there's just always this real restlessness and anxiety and panic of I can't stay still, I can't be here anymore. And as soon as they get onto the plane, then that instantly transfers for, oh my God, I can't stay on this plane either. It really says something about our desire to get from point A to point B that we put ourselves through it because there is sort of this. But I think that you and I both have the same airline. I think we both sold our soul to Delta.
I love Delta.
I call it the warm embrace of Delta. I really like it too.
Yeah. They're really nice. They have that funny little, if you haven't flown Delta, the safety video they make you watch, it's full of weird 1960s style visual jokes. It's like a Richard Lester directing a Beatles movie or something. It's crazy, like, right?
It's fun. It's like, it's good to see some personality in these things.
Yeah.
And a few of the airlines do it, right? I think, Virgin has a pretty stylish one. I saw the weirdest one on Air New Zealand, where they had an entirely Middle Earth themed talk.
I wonder why they did that.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
The pilot is Gollum. It's like, yeah, we're landing, Precious. No, we're not, Precious. Yes, we are, Precious.
That was nice. It's pilot and co-pilot. That's pretty good.
Yeah, he's the pilot and the co-pilot. That's yeah, okay. I think we exhausted the comedic possibilities there.
I'm not sure we even got there.
No, we didn't get there. We exhausted them without getting there. I totally agree. I think it's business travel where you get anxious, though. I think with other kinds of travel, like if you're visiting family or whatnot, it's different. But if you're trying to get to a business engagement, like you're pitching a client or you're speaking at a conference or something, there's this whole, wow, if I'm late, you know, will I be able to check into my room? Will my room be ready? The whole thing is just, I mean, I actually never worry about speaking. You do a lot of public speaking, as do I. I never actually worry about the speech. I just worry about the next thing I have to do. Like, am I going to get to the airport too early? Will I get there on time? How bad will the line be at TSA? Like all that stuff. I worry about that.
Yeah. You know, for me, it's not so much the logistics as overhearing other people's business phone calls. That's something that I found that for some reason I'm becoming really agitated by that. And you know what I think it is? It's the affectation of the business call. And there's like all this sort of posturing. And it's like, oh, he's a big boy. He can handle that. And, you know, it's sort of like, push harder. You know, it's like there's sort of this kind of crazy posturing that happens. And there's no doubt about it. In our world, we have tons of affectation around design. But, you know, that's our affectation. And somehow somebody else's, some other world's affectation becomes really grating in a way.
It's funny. Yeah. If like we seem to put up with all the affectation in our world and it's like, you know, the pretentious things that designers and consultants say don't seem to bother us that much. But if a guy who sells pencils starts being pretentious, there's something really wrong with our society.
Yeah, that's right. It's like, and there's this sign of like, it's like he's got this hotline to the underworld is what it sounds like on the phone. You know, it's anyway.
My favorite overhearing like that was on a train. I was taking a train to a friend had a guest house in upstate New York, and I was going to the friend's house, and it was like a 2-hour train ride, very pleasant through beautiful scenery. But the guy right behind me was on the phone, and this was before iPhones. This was before smartphones. It was just a clamshell. And so back then, when you didn't live on your phone, which is going to be the topic of today's session, if we ever get to it, if you didn't live on your phone, it was just a tool. And most people were polite enough not to make business calls, but this guy was making a 2-hour long, he was going to talk business the whole trip. So instead of sitting back, you know, having a refreshing beverage and watching the scenery, you were like, everyone was like listening to this guy. And he was angry. He was a landlord and really angry at all his tenants. And he was naming them. It was like, that's right. Myron Kaplan is 3 months late with the rent. I don't know. Since Myron Kaplan lost his job, I think because of his alcohol problem, he hasn't paid the rent in 3 months. And like everyone on the train is listening to this, but the capper is about, and I started turning around and scowling at him, but it did no good. And I wasn't like big enough to just get up and like quietly intimidate him. All I could do was really scowl. Toward the end of the trip, he goes, okay, he says into the phone, okay, we're about to go into a tunnel, so I got to get off. I'll talk to you later, Ma. And I don't know whether his mother was his business partner or this is just how he amused his parent, but wow.
So I think that from now on, maybe the remedy for me in my sort of peculiar agitation about hearing other people's business calls, I'm just going to pretend that everyone is talking to their mother.
That'll make it better.
I hope.
That will make it more fun.
I hope. I'm actually just generally surprised that people are actually using these things to make phone calls anymore. Like
that always, you know,
I do a fair amount to try to avoid the actual phone call, like scheduled calls. That's great. But you know, like just an off the cuff phone call is sort of something that feels really foreign to me now.
It even the few people that I have to actually talk and that I can't talk to over FaceTime or Skype or something where I have to actually use my minutes. It really, when AT&T tells me, it's like I have unlimited downloads, right? Basically I can be streaming audio and video all day long and I'm fine with that. But I run out of minutes for conversations and I'm like, you don't understand. I hate people. I hate conversations. I don't want to be on the phone at all. How can I be like running over on this?
Yeah. What if we had that in life? You know, it's like, you know what, Jeffrey, you've got 475 minutes of conversation left.
You know, I think I act as if I do. Like my social life is as if I have a very limited number of minutes
Well, I'm glad you're spending these with me.
I'm delighted. This is fun for me. See, for other people, this is a podcast. For me, this is like Friday night. Or in this case, Friday afternoon.
It's a pleasure. Take it when I can get it.
It is a pleasure to talk to you. You are the author of Designing for Touch, which is a book about this multi-device world that we live in and all the things that we do with fingers and multi-fingers and all that gestures in order to navigate. But mostly it's told from the point of view of the designer or the developer or the experience creator in terms of how should we design in this world where we're not sure we have hover and we don't necessarily know what a pixel is and we don't really know the dimensions of the device and all that stuff. But we do know about where people's fingers are going to reach, about where their thumbs are going to reach, and how do we design for this in an intuitive way, and how do we engage people in the experience? When do we teach them? You have a lot of stuff in the book, wonderful stuff about sort of teaching, as opposed to you remember the thing Koivin did years ago, how to use book?
Yeah, that it was great. And
it's in your book, but he treated the book the way. Well, you tell that. I mean, what was he doing with that? And
yeah, well, I mean, we still see this a lot, that when you get to sort of any interface, but for some reason, particularly around touch interface, because gestures, unlike buttons and tabs, don't have these labels or specific calls to action. So they have to be taught in some way. And so a lot of times, because this is often done as an afterthought, the approach is to just put one of those overlays on where they just sort of cram in every possible gesture and action that you can take in an interface.
And it's hateful, right? I mean, imagine if the first time you opened Photoshop, right, the interface was hidden. Imagine if you opened Photoshop and it was all gestural and everything you needed to do in Photoshop was explained in this one screen up front. Right. All the complexity.
Everything you need, but yeah, everything that you could do. All right,
everything you could do. Right. Yes, in a good interface, there's a couple things up front that they have to tell you, right?
Yeah. And hopefully the basics are self-evident. You know, hopefully the very basics of getting started, you can do anything without any help. But, of course, with anything with enough complexity, you're going to have to introduce some new concepts as you go. And it's a matter of finding the right moment.
It kind of depends on the content type, too. I mean, although I sometimes get a new photo app and it baffles me with all this upfront stuff that seems pointless, in general, if I have a photo app, it's like there's a picture of a camera or a picture of a real roll of film. So I, basically like pick the photos you've already taken and start doing something with them or take a new photo. I mean, and if I pick the photos I've already done, it's like select one. That's kind of obvious. And if I select it, some things appear like filters or, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Or cropping tools. It's usually... And yet some people, for whatever reason, think it's fun in a new camera app to just have completely bizarre, almost like they were doing CD-ROM games from the 90s, sort of mystery navigation and mystery gestures and all that. What do you think that's about? Is that just inexperience?
Well, I think a lot of thought is going into how can we design new kinds of experiences for these new inputs and outputs. So handheld touchscreen devices, I think that properly designers are trying to think what's sort of the new ways and appropriate ways to interact with information. Unfortunately, a lot of that we aren't giving the same thought to how do we bring our audience into this, that a lot of times the education aspect, which should be just cooked right into the design and developed alongside with the design, almost this education layer that sits on top, that's left as an afterthought. And so it's sort of in the, oh man, we're going to release this thing in 3 days. We got to do something. And so these things feel bolted on or just thrown as an overlay on top as a one screener. And then you're done.
The way the thing Coy was making fun of when he showed a book and said, like he showed dog earring and said like highlight selected pages.
Yeah, that's right. So here's the most elegant interface that we've yet to come up with. It's a book, so easy, so simple. And what he showed is that if you overlay everything you could do to this book all at once, it becomes overwhelming. So yeah, it was like the left pages are your unread content and the right pages, or the right pages are your unread content, and the left pages are your reading history. And right, you can dog ear it as it's a save feature, you know, for the, so, and it seemed overwhelming.
It was a beautiful finger wag to our industry and wake up calls. So like, okay, you're designers, so design. That's not designing. If you make something so it doesn't reveal in time, if it doesn't contextually make people aware of what they can do next, if you try to cram all that stuff in up front because you didn't think about it during the experience, you're not really designing. It was a beautiful way of saying that, I thought. And in contrast to that, you recommend playing more video games. I've often heard you say, go play video games. Why do you say that to designers? Go play video games.
Right. And designers and developers are always happy to hear that particular device or advice, it sounds like. But yes. The idea is that, you know, I think that game designers, in a way, are some of our most talented and inspired interaction designers. And the reason is because they are doing something that must be enjoyable. You know, that I don't want to read a big manual before I start playing a game. I just want to get into it. And the thing about the games is that often you don't even know what your goal is, or let alone your abilities or the obstacles that you're about to overcome. And so the challenge inherent in any game, which is, you know, also has to have some freshness and new dynamics to it, some mystery to be unveiled, to be successful, is that they have to teach you in context. And, you know, it's not all at once. It's sort of, you learn these first stages, and there's naturally this idea of levels or challenges that you unlock in these games as you steadily improve and learn the game dynamics.
Yeah, you've talked about that. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
It's not like they give you this sort of block of text to read at the beginning. There's often these environmental cues that something kind of animates a little bit to get your attention, so you explore it. And it's just at the moment that you need that skill or that talent, you know? So that's the moment that we're most motivated to learn something, is at the precise moment that we realize we need it.
Right. And we're more likely to remember it if we learned it just at the moment we needed it.
That's it.
Yeah. DreamHost. Let's thank DreamHost first of all. Since 1997, DreamHost has helped entrepreneurs and developers the world over bring their dreams, hence the name, to life on the internet. They offer domain registrations, web hosting, and even powerful cloud storage and computing services. Now, 1.5 million plus websites, WordPress blogs, and applications are hosted by DreamHost. They have more than 400,000 customers spanning over 100 countries. DreamHost is the best place to launch a blog, a website, or a web application into the stratosphere. They're home to over 750,000 WordPress installations and have a helpful staff of professional WordPress experts. They're the proud winner of PC Magazine's Business Choice Award for Best Web Hosting Service and have been a recommended hosting solution by WordPress.org since 2005. DreamHost offers the hosting solution for individual websites or high-volume enterprise sites and makes it simple to upgrade if your needs change at any time. Plus, they have award-winning in-house support available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and you can test them. You can call them at New Year's Eve. You can call them on Christmas Day. You can call them on my birthday, which should be observed as a holiday. Call them anytime. They are there to help you. DreamHost is giving listeners of this show a special offer. Visit DreamHost.com to sign up and make sure to use the code TheBigWebShow395. TheBigWebShow395 at checkout. And you'll get top-rated web hosting for just $3.95 a month. It's not $395. That's $3.95. Check out it with the Big Web Show 395, and you will get top-rated web hosting for just $3.95 a month, plus a free domain name. So thank you to DreamHost for supporting 5x5 and the Big Web Show. I have a kid who's in fifth grade now, and I think, and you know, I admire their teachers, and I know they're working really hard, but I think one of the frustrations for kids in school is that they don't know why they're learning things. A lot of times, like, why do I have to, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do math. So why do I have to learn? And it's like, you have, the way school works, you have to learn in advance skills that will come in handy and be second nature later in your life. but it's very hard to be motivated to learn something that you don't have a particular need for or a particular interest in. And if school was like game design or like good app design, which is what we're talking about here, you would learn things just at the moment that you needed to learn them. And then you would really remember them.
Yeah. Well, and part of it too is, you know, how do you actually make it feel like it's not work, you know, that it's right. a sort of something that is in the flow of your day. And of course that's a challenge for any kind of education. But it's also, I think it's tricky because obviously gamification is sort of this thing that we bandy about. And often right. it takes the form of here's some empty badges, you know, that actually really you don't actually attach that much value to. But when you think about what happens in games that sort of tickle those endorphins and in any kind of game, board games, video games, whatever, it's not so much that you win a virtual prize. It's that you're getting better at it, you know, that you're sort of developing this new knowledge. And that's something that applies to even the most kind of mundane activities that we have. You know, you might be an expert at Illustrator and then somebody comes up and says, oh, you're doing it that way? Did you know about this? And all of a sudden, right. it's like, you know, you get this thrill of learning something, of developing that mastery and expertise, of making your life a little bit better, even in this sort of mundane aspect of your life. And that's the stuff that we can deliver as designers in any kind of experience, whether that's a retail experience or a touchscreen experience. But, you know, one of the things we're talking about is, you know, how do we teach the new stuff that's not obvious? And I think one of the things actually about designing for touch is that we can design things that do feel more obvious and more natural, but it's a real departure. And this is what much of the book is about, is the idea that now we're actually designing a physical interface, that we're moving away from or adding to, I should say, the conventions that we normally apply to this, which is that, you know, normally we think of the work that we do as visual design. Well, it can be no buttons for sure, but even if we do have buttons, they've got to feel right in the hand, you know, whereas before there's sort of no strong ergonomic demands of where things must go on the screen. Certainly there are some, but when you're actually imposing this interface onto a glass slab in your hand or maybe on your desk for sort of larger and larger screens that we're starting to see touchscreens emerge on, you have to design not only for how the pixels look, but how they feel. You know, how do these pixels feel in the hand?
I hate to bring up skeuomorphic versus flat. That's such a played. That was a boring conversation 5 years ago when we started having it, but it really applies here, don't you think? Because, you know, an elegant flat design, does it still feel like I'm pushing a button when I'm pushing a button? Do things look like, if things look like what they are in the real world, that helps me understand what they are. I mean, that's why the original iPhone looked so the way it did and seemed like, you know, that's why it had all those drop shadows and all that other junk that we as designers sniffed at originally. Like, oh my God, beveled edges. I haven't done that since Photoshop 5.5. That's ridiculous, beveled edges. But there was a reason for it.
Yeah. Well, you know, so I want to go out there and say right now that I am a huge fan of skeuomorphic design. And I'm not necessarily talking about the visual aspect of it, which I think is the part that we've often focused on. It's like, oh, it looks like a button versus a flat thing. The more important part, and I would say that you know, these are things that come in and out of fashion. You know, the beveled edge was really hot for a while. The organic textures that iOS introduced and really made popular, that was everywhere for a while. Yep. So these things, the visual aspects naturally have a certain fashion. But what's consistent among all of them is that they behave with true physicality. They behave as if these were physical objects. And this is the real thinking shift that designing for touch requires, is reimagining data objects as physical objects that we can stretch and flick and move around. And what is the metaphorical action that you're taking on when you're manipulating, when you're creating the illusion of touching the information itself? And that creates all these new opportunities. I mean, our brains work differently with this. I mean, fascinating study that came out is that people, when they are using a touchscreen to browse objects versus a mouse and cursor to browse like a commerce store, will say that the objects that they're touching are worth more. they'll assign a greater value to the things that they're touching on the touchscreen than that they're manipulating with a mouse. There is some tricky stuff that happens when we create this illusion of direct contact with information that goes pretty deep down, and that we sort of have to realize.
Yeah, even just enlarging something by drag, by the pinch zoom, is completely different than clicking a button that lets me open a new light box or something.
Yeah, that's right.
And then scroll around a light box. One feels, you know, nobody has to teach me the interface because I learned it years ago with the mouse cursor, and it's the you know, the keyboard, and I get that. But there is this sort of separation, and there is this artificiality to it that, in some weird way, there's a sense of control that you get, a feeling of possession that you get when you're touching. Because, like, that's what we do, right? We touch the people we love. We want to feel possession of our lovers. And we, like, hold them. This is getting into a weird area, but I think it's the same, right? Touch is more intimate.
That's right. And there's a thing, you know, I mean, look, the laptop that I use day to day does not have a touch screen, but it's covered with my fingerprints. I mean, we're kind of constantly sort of reaching out and touching things, even when they don't respond in return, in terms of this new interaction that we've been working with for the last several years. But now it's a powerful thing when it does respond, you know.
Have you ever tried to enlarge, like, a piece of paper, like type on a piece of paper just accidentally without thinking about it? Because I've done that.
Yeah, like when you're getting tired, it's like when sort of brain's a little bit woozy, and that definitely happens. Yeah.
You're reading the label of a medicine thing, and you're middle aged, so you can't really. And they typeset it in like 7-point type, right? Like, warning: if you're on this medicine, don't take that medicine, or dosage, or any of that stuff. Wow, this sounds really, really geriatric. So when you're old and taking medicine, but you can't see because your eyes aren't what they used to be. Anyway, so the young part of it is that I go like, I do a pinch zoom, It doesn't work, and I've done it on printouts for tickets, too. There was fine print on a ticket somewhere I was going. I was like, well, what's this? You know, it was like an airline ticket back to Delta, and there was fine print. And I actually tried to enlarge it, and then I was like, wow. But it makes me think paper's a hack. It's a great hack. It's been a brilliant hack since the Egyptians invented papyrus. But it's kind of almost done. I love paper books and always will. But I should always be able to change the size of type. That should just be something I'm allowed to do on any interface that anyone designs, because one person has great vision and another person has impaired vision. Like, you know, someday soon, I would think these screens are going to be more like, you know, thinner and thinner surfaces until basically everything can be a screen that we can interact with.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think this is an interesting thing that you mentioned. The corollary that I have so often is when I lose something, like whatever, like I can't find my keys, and I'm like, oh, I'll just search for them. It's like, wait, that doesn't happen. But increasingly, it kind of is. So on the one hand, we sort of started talking about how our digital interfaces are becoming more physical, that we're touching them, we're holding them in our hands, we're creating this illusion of physicality, of manipulating information as if it was physical. And then on the other side, and you're kind of alluding to this, where sort of like information is embedded everywhere in the physical environment, or me trying to use a search engine to find my keys. That's happening too, that we're starting to make physical objects have a digital presence. And what's really interesting is these things are beginning to happen simultaneously. And at the center of both of these things is the smartphone, which has the touch screen and lets us bring our digital information into the physical world. But it's also loaded with these sensors that let us talk to physical objects. So on one hand, we've got these are two areas that I'm really involved with in my client work, is how do we start to teach digital designers to behave like industrial designers in their touch screen apps, very much a theme of this book. And then on the other side, we've got, how do we teach industrial designers to start to think about and incorporate digital services into their objects? And often, as I said, it's a smartphone that's linking both of those worlds together.
We also want to thank Braintree. Braintree. And if you buy or sell anything on the web, you have heard of e-commerce, you've worked with e-commerce, and Braintree makes e-commerce easy and available to everyone. Braintree is code for easy online payments. If you're building a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. The Braintree V.0 SDK makes it easy to offer multiple payment types. Start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, cards, and more, all with a single integration. It's just one small snippet of code, and you're set up in less than 10 minutes. There's a quick knowledge team of quick, knowledgeable developer support folks if you have questions. And again, it's Apple Pay, PayPal, Bitcoin, Venmo cards, and whatever comes next, all with a single integration, all set up in under 10 minutes. Okay, to learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions without a fee, go to braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. Braintree's SDKs are available in 7 languages: .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. It's all elegant code with clear documentation, and it's all just 10 lines of in-app code. If you don't have the time to implement it yourself, give them a call, and they'll even handle the integration for you and walk you through it. Braintree code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. So, to learn more and to get your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, I just love saying that, fee-free, to get your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. Thank you, Braintree, for sponsoring 5x5 and the Big Web Show, and thank you, DreamHost. And thank you, A Book Apart, who are giving a 15% discount on Josh's new book, Design for the Big Web Show, Designed for Touch. If you go to abookapart.com and type DFT Big Web, it's good for 15% off Josh's book, but it's only valid until the end of January. So don't delay, buy today. And with that, we are back with Josh Clark talking about designing things that feel obvious and natural, designing a physical interface for a variety of glass screens, reimagining digital objects as physical objects, and reimagining physical objects as digital objects. Hi, Josh.
Hello, and thanks for mentioning that discount code on the book. You really can't afford not to buy it, I think.
With a discount like that, you can't afford not to buy, exactly.
That's right. For all those sponsors, actually. We were talking about Delta, the warm embrace of Delta, but warm embrace of DreamHost and Braintree. It's amazing that these services, I mean, $395 for web hosting. I mean, it's
incredible, right?
It is incredible.
That's crazy. $395 is crazy.
Yeah.
Seriously, excuse me. Like coffee costs more.
No, it's right. And the cup of coffee serves many less people.
It does, and that's not one cup of coffee a month. If you have one cup of coffee a month, that would mean 29 days where you're holding your left eye going, oh, God, I can't wake up. Are you a coffee addict?
You know, I am. And I just saw a study this week, and of course these studies like change on a dime, it seems, week to week, but I was happy to see that if you drink 3 to 5 cups of coffee a day, men live 15% longer. So I don't know. I'll hold on to that study until the one next week that says that they died much earlier. But anyway,
they live
good
longer.
News this week.
They live longer, but they get penis cancer is what I heard.
I see. There's always that
but,
trade-off.
You know, it's a trade-off. I mean, design is a series of trade-offs.
I got to confess, I didn't think those two words would come up together during this hour, but I'm glad they have.
Which words? Design trade-offs?
Well, no, that's a totally fine. It was more the cancer.
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't know why. That's a horrible thing to make jokes about. I'm just, and of course, that wasn't really a joke. So
we're spreading awareness. We're doing.
I'm just spreading dementia because I. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. Now I feel terrible. The show's over.
Okay. We can rescue it. We can turn it all around.
You can do this.
Because this is the 139th episode, and the previous 138 have just been leading right up to this one.
It's true. They were all a slow build. Let's talk about multi-finger gestures.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I think one of the things when you look at the gestures that we're all super familiar with and how to use a touchscreen, that it's, you know, it's a tap, it is a long press, it is double tap, pinch,
and now a deep press.
And a deep press, right? Which is, you know, it's sort of essentially like a long press, like the right click of the touchscreen in a sense.
But it you also feels very physical.
Yeah, that's right.
Like you're pushing deeper into the glass. It feels that way. It convinces you that that's happening.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that we're, you know, long press as a gesture on apps has been really inconsistent and so sort of often not well understood or discovered by people. And I'm concerned that this force touch, as Apple calls it, 3D touch, is something that will only make that worse in the sense that, you know, you need to sort of have some real consistency in the way that it's applied. And of course there's differences of sort of like, oh, I'm pushing deeper, has a different effect. This sort of thing of where you can kind of peek into an email if you press a little bit and then open it if you press a little bit harder. You know,
if you do it the wrong way without meaning to, then all of a sudden you get the little X's over all your apps because it thinks that you're trying to delete something trying to rearrange your apps.
So it's a long press versus a hard press or a deep press.
Right.
So it's talking about this kind of layer of real nuance of how you touch the device, and it's
yoga. It's really yoga. It's yoga for your fingertips.
There you go.
It's like super subtle body movement, super subtle muscular control, and like that makes a difference between do you ever stand up straight and then you actually stand up straight and you're 2 inches taller than you thought you were because you really weren't standing up straight that whole time?
Yeah, right.
You're activating other core muscles and stuff and your skeleton straightens. And it's like, we're doing that. We're going to have super fit fingers is what I'm saying.
I love it. That's great. It's like, right. And if you're right-handed, you'll have like this sort of overdeveloped sort of thumb and forefinger on your right hand, perhaps. Or more just, you know, probably just your, you know, often really all these things, you know, mostly are single touch interactions. I mean, the thing is that all of these sort of common gestures that we've been talking about are really just ported mouse gestures. You know, it's like
so
here's
far,
the minimum we needed to sort of move stuff over from the mouse and cursor world and port it over to touch. You know, and that's really all it is sort of jabbing. And, you know, even pinch and spread, which is a two-finger action, is kind of like a mouse wheel. You know, there's in terms of its zooming role. And so we've really only begun to scratch the surface of how expressive our hands can be. I mean,
you said scratch the surface, which itself sounds like a touch gesture. I must go ahead.
We'll have to have one. You know, I mean, there are all these gestures.
That could be, that should
make it
range. That should be a thing. Like if you scratch the surface, almost like rubbing off a lottery ticket number, right? If you scratch the surface, then you automatically bring forward like mouse tips or, you know, it's almost like hover. You bring forward cues and tips that were hidden in the interface.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I do a fair amount of workshops and seminars with companies or with groups of designers around how to get this sort of new perspective on what designing for a touchscreen means and how it's different from designing for a mouse and cursor interface. And one of the things that we do is really, you know, lock in on the fact that so many of these things are card-based. You know, the operating systems are really embrace the card metaphor. And when you start to explore, well, what are all the things that you could do to a physical card? I mean, again, this is, you know, really we're just creating this illusion that we're moving cards or little sort of almost slips of paper underneath glass. What are all the things that you can do to a card? You know, you can fold it, you can crush it, you can flick it away, you can deal it into a deck, stack it. And you can do these things like you're saying, of sort of, you know, scratching the surface or dog-earing it or, you know, flipping them fast, the sort of the make it rain, pay, you know, sort of like flipping through your money, right? And so, you know, this is as people explore this and I just actually give them physical cards and say, all right, we're going to design an app now. And there's no buttons. There's no stuff on this. This is like, imagine that all these cards were pieces of information. And what are all the things that you could do to this information? What's the corresponding sort of intuitive data metaphor for if you're actually folding a card that is a piece of information. What does that mean or represent? And it comes up.
And how will you then replicate that on this piece of glass?
Yeah.
What a wonderful design exercise. Like you might accordion something, right? You might fold it up just nervously. And then what does accordion translate into when it's a piece of glass that the glass, you can't fold the glass, but can you fold the interface in some way? And what should the interface visually do that will convince you that you're doing that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think one of the Lauren Brichter, who I think is somebody who is one of the really sort of great thinkers about how to deal with touch interfaces and creating that sort of true feeling physicality. He worked at Apple on the first iOS release, and then sort of was better known for creating an app called Tweety, which was then adopted by Twitter. And he created the first iPad app for Twitter, which I think he still remains sort of as one of the most really thoughtful gesture-based ways to move through Twitter. And they replaced it to sort of make all of their apps and platforms feel more consistent, which I think is a shame. But yeah, he was actually playing with that accordion idea of you could sort of open up, I think it was a profile at the time. You sort of could sort of spread it open and it would accordion out this little and reveal information about the profile of whoever had posted a tweet. It's like these really kind of thoughtful ideas of what happens if these are little cards that you can manipulate under glass and starting to be expressive, you know, much beyond just this poking and jabbing that we do with mouse and cursor and that most of our touch interfaces are limited to now. What else might we do? Because, you know, I mean, our hands are, you know, when we open a pickle jar, they're more expressive than what we're doing on touch screens with this sensitivity to pressure and rotation. And how do we start to think about the role of that kind of expressiveness? Much of the book is about changing the way that we approach this purely physical interface to find ways that are more intuitive, more ergonomically comfortable, and give users an economy of motion, but also really embrace this illusion of physicality that we have, that we can push aside the buttons and tabs and all this administrative debris that we've accumulated over the last 30 years of graphic user interface design and really say, lean into the way that our brains work and expect them to work with this illusion of physicality on the screen. Because when you look at the way that kids get it, they get it immediately because it works the way the rest of the world works. And they don't have to learn these arbitrary conventions that we've established over the last 30 years. Instead, it goes into the way that our brains have developed over millions of years.
Yes, beautifully said. I noticed, but my daughter is a little bit older than the iPhone. So when she was old enough to understand how gravity worked, that's when the iPhone came out, and it's been perfect. And it took her years to get the computer. I would show her the computer, keyboard and mouse, just it made no sense to her at all. But she could do anything with it. Before she could talk, she could do anything with an iPhone, and she still gets interfaces better than I do. And I've been designing them for more than 20 years, right?
Isn't it incredible? There's that separation too, you know. So now, Apple, for example, has started to introduce gestures on its Mac apps, you know, so that you can, you know, in the same way that you can swipe across an email message on iOS, they're letting you do a swipe across an email message using your trackpad. But the whole thing kind of breaks in a way. I mean, it's okay, convenient, but it's not at all that immediate thing of, oh, I'm crossing out this item with my finger directly. It has a whole different kind of resonance and understanding.
Right. It's like you're controlling a virtual reality body instead of just using your body. So you're looking into some goggles and you're touching something and it makes a fake digital hand do something, but it's not the same at all.
Yeah.
Not the same. I don't know if that was the right metaphor, but yeah.
No, I mean, we've been using this prosthetic, the mouse and the cursor, to point at stuff from a distance, you know, using this weird plastic brick for a long time and now trackpads.
What about Windows laptops that are sort of tablets? And now, of course, with the iPad Pro, Apple's finally going into that same territory where it's an iPad, it's a tablet, but it's also a screen that has a keyboard attached to it. Is there something There's something easy when I have a phone or a small tablet with moving my thumbs. But once I set that tablet upright and have a keyboard next to it, taking my hands off the keyboard and gesturing and then going down again seems, it just feels weird to me. It's like I'm trying to speak English and French at the same time, like one or the other.
Well, it's really interesting. Well, you know, for a long time, there was a real knock against this. And Steve Jobs was somebody who was really skeptical that this combination could ever work. He said, you know, touchscreens don't want to be vertical. No one wants to work with what he called gorilla arms, you know, arms up in the air. It just feels awkward and uncomfortable. And of course, he's right. Nobody does want to work like that. What you do find, however, is that people don't work with their arms in the air when they do this. So first of all, people do, when you start to use this, really quickly adopt the touchscreen. And it's not that the touchscreen replaces the keyboard or the keyboard replaces the touchscreen when these systems are built right. It's more sort of like, what feels most natural? And you see people switching back and forth or just sort of embracing the touchscreen or going all in on the keyboard. One of the problems right now, John Gruber wrote a great review about this for the new smart keyboard with iPad Pro, is that keyboard isn't quite yet a full keyboard. Like iOS wasn't first designed to run with a keyboard. And so all these kinds of ways that you think about using keyboard computing aren't yet supported. When that stuff does start to happen, when the keyboard is, there's a full keyboard or there's a full touchscreen, then what you see is people fluidly move between them, between what feels right. So it's this idea of having kind of an extra gear that's available to you if you want it. But what you also find is that people who have typically been what you might call keyboard power users, who, you know, normally whatever, tab through fields and a form field, start to switching to actually touching that form field. Again, there's something irresistible about touch. And again, like I said, you know, I don't have a touchscreen laptop, but my screen is covered with my own fingerprints. There's this, you do see this fluid motion, but also the way that people deal with it is that they rest their arms alongside the keyboard, almost cradling the touchscreen in their hand, so that your hands come to rest at the bottom left and right corners. And the behavior that you start to see is not lifting your whole arm up to reach into it, but letting your arms rest and sort of using your thumbs at the corners and edges and sometimes reaching into the center of the canvas, but using your thumbs. And so we favor naturally, of course, because we're, you know, kind of human nature is fairly lazy. We favor this economy of motion. And what it means is that for all of the different handheld touchscreens, including, you know, these hybrid devices of touchscreen and keyboard that we're seeing in laptops and tablets with keyboards, from the smallest screens to the largest screens, we're using our thumbs. And so the real starting question for our layouts is not just where do the eyes naturally come to rest, but where do thumbs come to rest on the device? Because that's actually what you have to change. And the book goes into all these details of how do we adapt our layouts to support touch. And because, especially for the web, we can't know with certainty whether something has a touch screen, I believe that every desktop layout now has to be designed for touch. And it's a little bit of a responsive design dilemma, because we've had this kind of crummy idea that screen size could be a proxy for whether it's a touch screen. Oh, it's a small screen, so it's touch. Oh, it's a big screen, so it's mouse and cursor. It's a bad idea to begin with. And it's turned out to really fall apart now with these modern devices that are coming out.
Yep. So how do you do that? How do you design an interface that will always have touch support and make sure that it has, it seems like progressive enhancement almost doesn't begin to cover the many layers of complexity toward even the simplest layout. If it's got to be completely touch supporting, but also be completely discoverable in traditional ways, how does that work? Right.
And by the way, let's you know, our lives get even more complicated than that, because hopefully we've always been supporting screen readers with voice-based interfaces. But as those become popular, and you can imagine these starting to show up in our cars, voice-based browsers, You know, how is it going to support that? And not just voice over here and touch over there and keyboard and mouse over there, but this idea that all these devices support all of them at once and people are going to be moving fluidly among them. But the one of the things that the book does is it identifies essentially what the thumb zones are. What are the areas that require the least motion and physical action of moving your hand, or sometimes in the case of larger screens, your whole arm? How can you resist that? It shows these, what I'm calling the thumb zones for all these different screens, which are places where you can put frequent controls. And it turns out that while a handheld tablet and a hybrid, a touch keyboard hybrid, like a laptop or a tablet with a keyboard attached, while they have slightly different thumb zones, they do overlap. And what it means is starting to favor the edges of screen, this left and right edges of screens for primary controls, and not the top, which is often what we do, or the bottom, you know, sort of pinning toolbars to the top or bottom of screens. Happily, it turns out that the aspect ratio of more and more of our screens, particularly these when you attach a keyboard to them, are getting wider. And so it actually turns out, you know, those are pretty good places for controls, because we don't have very much vertical space compared to these widescreen horizontal space that we have. So a lot of this stuff, what this book goes into, is, you know, the things that we consider to be best practices are no longer best practices. And in order to accommodate touch, we need to change the way that we think about our designs. And part of this is not all that different to a couple of the web sort of revolutions, if you will, that we've seen in the past. One that you were really central to, Jeffrey, it was, you know, the move to web standards and the, you know, moving away from tables and doing CSS-based design, separating content from presentation. That was like one big, you know, revolution that we went to. And there was responsive design, obviously, in the last few years that we're still adapting to.
Right.
But if that idea was, oh, there's no one true output for the web, what we're finding is, oh, there's no one true input either.
Right.
And we need to, you know, use progressive enhancement to sort of add these layers of input to things.
That is such a beautiful thing. And we may have to stop about there, which is really sad, because I think we could talk about this book and touch design for hours to come. I mean, we basically surfacely packed at a couple of grains of the book, but there's so much more here. People can find you. You're now Big Medium Josh. Used to be Global Moxie on Twitter, but now you are Big. What happens with Global Moxie, by the way? I haven't checked. Does it just say go to Big Medium Josh now?
I have the worst problem. I think a lot of designers listening to this probably have this. It's like a total cobbler's children situation, where it's like, I'm doing such a lousy job of making the shoes for myself. And so my own web presence often lingers. So the old Global Moxie site is still out there, but what you really want to do is go to bigmedium.com, which is sort of my presence and a name that I chose to really emphasize how the internet is a truly big medium that's even expanding beyond screens now.
No, you chose it so that Ev will come to you and say, by the way, we're medium and we really want to buy Big Medium, just so there's no confusion. So
right.
I got a couple of my investors together, and they got some petty cash, a few million dollars in petty cash to just... No, I'm joking, of course. But
maybe I should buy that.
Did you worry about that? Did you worry about that?
No.
Like, you switched to Big Medium?
Nah.
Really?
Nah. Yeah, I didn't worry about it. But I don't know. I've got a small design studio that's so small that it's actually just me, but I bring together teams of people to work with on really interesting, engaging, big design projects. But what that means is that my, I don't have to worry about really, I would say, kind of confusing millions of people with my brand or another. It's, I've got a fairly tight story to tell, and I think the audience gets it without being confused by medium.com versus bigmedium.com.
I was actually joking, of course, but...
Yeah. Actually, the problem for me is that people think I'm saying Big Media.
Oh.
Which is funny because I think the sizes go together better. You know, the big, medium, or it sounds like a really sort of a large clairvoyant.
No, it's a joke. It's a joke. I mean, big, medium is a play. Big media isn't a play. And big media is the old fashioned, is the thing that this isn't. It's the opposite. Like big media is like ABC, NBC, CBS. That's big media. Or, you know, Time Inc. is big media.
Yeah, right. Right.
Big medium is a different thing. Besides that, you are available on Vimeo at Big Medium Josh, on GitHub as Big Medium, on Instagram as Josh Clark. So that's
still because Josh you don't Clark.
Have, yeah, because you don't have a Big Medium feed yet on Instagram, which is, you know, I get that because it's kind of a virtual company. You're the author of two books, Designing for Touch and the previous masterpiece, Tapworthy. People can find you also. Are you blogging anywhere these days?
I've been doing a fair amount of stuff on the Pastry Box project, which this is their last year, going into their last month. So I'm writing a lot of essays kind of all over the place, and coming soon, opening that back up at my site at bigmedium.com.
Okay, that'll be good. That will be good indeed. You have a weird, there's a strange thing with your CSS hover where it doesn't completely cover the, wow. If in Safari on a desktop, when I hover over Josh Clark and friends, the text turns gray except for the very tops, which are still red.
Isn't that weird?
I have no, just, have you seen that? It's true.
I haven't noticed that.
It's on all your links. You're doing something too tricky with hover, but maybe that's to make it work on an Android device.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I was doing anything too crafty there. There you go. This is another. It's not doing it on my Safari.
Okay, I'll take a screenshot for you.
Funny, yeah. Well, there you go. This is again the cobbler's shoes.
No, this is probably just a browser problem.
I'll take that. That sounds even better.
Yeah. We can always blame the browser. Never blame the designer. Right? Right there. What is this? Don't blame the user. But if the user's at fault, it's the designer's problem. But rather than say that, let's just blame the browser.
That sounds good.
Thank you for your time today, Big Medium Josh. Thank you for writing Designing for Touch. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you to 5x5 for running this network and hosting this show. And thank you to DreamHost and Braintree for sponsoring this show and for making wonderful products. We'll see you again on another Big Web show.